W252 DR Oshkosh and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Chinese spy balloon is now heading toward the East Coast. The Pentagon now talking about possibly shooting it down. ABC News contributor Colonel Steve Ganyard, a former defense and State Department official, says that would have been easier when the balloon was first spotted.
The Pentagon said that they detected it out over the Aleutians, way to the west, and it went up over Alaska. Those are not heavily populated areas. So days ago, it was a political decision not to shoot it down. Now it's a safety issue.
The idea not shooting it down when it crosses the East Coast over the Atlantic, but before it drifts into international waters. Much of the nation in the grips of a deep freeze, the Northeast feeling the extreme chill overnight. Wind chill approaching 60 degrees below zero in parts of New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and a blizzard morning. Whiteout conditions as well. Pope Francis starting his first full day on his visit to South Sudan, the world's newest country, beset by conflict, poverty, and humanitarian crises, by encouraging priests and nuns to serve their flocks by joining in their tears. This is ABC News. A new Labor Department report revealed another strong month for American jobs in January, bringing an unexpectedly robust 517,000 new jobs and bringing the unemployment rate to 3.4%. That's the country's lowest since 1969. ABC Chief Business Correspondent Rebecca Jarvis has more.
The hiring is widespread across nearly every industry. By far the strongest is leisure and hospitality, which added more than 100,000 jobs, with Americans continuing to spend money on travel and dining out. Professional jobs, despite the fact that we've seen those layoffs at major tech companies, hold strong.
More U.S. aid to Ukraine and its war with Russia. The $2 billion package includes longer-range precision-guided rockets and artillery ammunition. A California jury has sided with Tesla CEO Elon Musk, finding he did not defraud investors in 2018 when he tweeted that he had secured funding to take Tesla private at $420 a share when, in fact, the deal was not in place. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Keeping the Fox Valley connected, informed, and entertained. This is Civic Media.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. There's a constitutional amendment on Wisconsin ballots in April which would give courts more discretion when setting bail for dangerous defendants. The idea is to protect the public, but critics say the cash bail system is unfair and ought to be scrapped. Mike Moen reports.
Marianne Olson with the Wisconsin group Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing says the conversation should be about eliminating cash bail.
A bail system that is based on cash is based on what you can afford. Where is the community safety in that? Where is the justice in that?
Her group believes the practice contributes to Wisconsin leading the U.S. in incarcerating black defendants. She argues cash bail also disproportionately affects women and their families. Currently in Wisconsin, bail is only tied to court appearances. Bill sponsors say judges should base these decisions on more information, including a person's past criminal record, to keep the public safe. But Olson says other approaches, such as ending the cash bail system, also keep public safety in mind.
If an accused came before a judge accused of a violent crime, there would be no cash bail. That person would stay. But a nonviolent offender would be able to be released, continue working, continue being part of their family.
Efforts to eliminate cash bail have surfaced in states like Illinois and California, but those plans have run into various obstacles. Sponsors of the Wisconsin amendment have suggested they'll introduce language to make it clear that only certain types of violent offenses should be applied to a judge's decision-making if the ballot question is approved. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
From Green Bay to Oshkosh and Point South, wherever you are in the Fox Valley, count on us to keep you connected, informed, and entertained. Civic Media.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous Ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
I'm Pat Kreitlow from Up North News. On an earlier edition, we talked to three women, med students, about whether they're going to stay in Wisconsin to practice medicine.
All this Roe v. Wade stuff, and now OBGYN's hands are so tied. I don't want to go through 12 years of training to have some person that didn't do training tell me how to do my job.
It is not a binary choice. You're for or against abortion. It is a healthcare decision. We all have those stories, and people want to hear them.
Don't miss the real stories here on Up North News.
Continue the conversation online. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook and on Twitter.
Morning Cannolis with James Centel is an independent product and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
This is the second hour of our time together, our analysis, our review, our discussion of the most important stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you so much for joining me in this second hour, this Saturday, February 4th. We are taking a survey through many of the important stories of this past week and in this hour from a previous week related to the imposition of justice, the pursuit of law in America. And right before our break, at the top of the hour, we were talking about this trend involving defendants in the January 6th insurrection, the riot, of confessing, of acknowledging in court that they have, in fact, understood that what they did on January 6th, the assault on the Capitol, about 1,000 of them altogether, was, in fact, in violation of the law. And then going out there and telling media and telling other sources, other public venues, that in fact, they don't believe any of that, that they still feel very strongly about the rightness of their decision. And the fact that judges are beginning to push back on that and beginning to rescind, if you will, the convictions that were entered and telling them that they can't have it both ways. And that is a good news story for the rule of law. We'll watch that down the road. And right before the top of the hour break, we were also talking about this highly disturbing, very, very concerning decision coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that says that a federal law, 18 U.S.C. Section 922, which bars individuals, people, from possessing weapons if they're subject to a domestic violence prohibition or restraining order for harassing, stalking, or threatening an intimate partner, that you can't hold weapons, you can't possess weapons. It's been the law in the United States for a very long time. People convicted of it appropriately as a way of promoting our safety and security. The Court of Appeals, again, in this case just last week, called the United States versus Rahimi, found that Mr. Rahimi's conviction premised upon that statute could not stand, invoking the case of Heller, a decision written by Justice Antonin Scalia many, many years ago, and a more recent case called Bruin, written by Clarence Thomas just this past summer, that both of those cases that look back in time, look back in history, to try to support the legitimacy of a current contemporary statute. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel, finds they can't do that. And so rules unconstitutional, this statute that draws a line between domestic abusers and other people and says you can't own a weapon if indeed you are a domestic abuser, and says that's unconstitutional. United States Department of Justice appropriately says we're going to pursue this. We're not going to let this stand. And the Attorney General committing to an appeal to the United States Supreme Court on this issue. So it will come up again. Rahimi is the name of the case. Again, a matter for concern by all Americans who are concerned about safety and security. This is the kind of thing that courts do when they undermine our basic understanding, not only about the law, the criminal law, but about our need to ensure that this gun violence in America is stopped, that we don't have this continuing problem, not only with mass shootings, but other abuses and misuses of firearms. The Second Amendment does not contemplate the kinds of things that Mr. Rahimi did, and the Fifth Circuit ruling should, in fact, be subject to review and reversal by the United States Supreme Court. We'll see if they take that case on and tell the Fifth Circuit and the rest of us that 922 that prohibits people who are engaged in domestic violence should, in fact, be prohibited from possessing, using firearms, that should remain the law of the land as it has been. This hour, we're going to continue with that discussion about many important issues in the news. And again, as always, we invite your phone calls at 844-967-2789. My producer, Calvin, and I are interested in soliciting, encouraging your thoughts, your comments, your questions, your perspectives about these and other items of news. Let's go from the Fifth Circuit to a place further south, but not too far further south, on the Cuban island, and in particular, the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. Guantanamo Bay, we haven't heard a lot about that recently. Recall well that during the campaign for the presidency many years ago, Barack Obama committed to closing down Guantanamo Bay as what he viewed as an unconstitutional place of detention. And the reason for that is just this. And this by way of background with respect to one of the defendants who's been held there for a very, very long time, who was in the news this past week. We're going to talk about him in just a moment or so. It turns out that for many, many years, there were the Pentagon, our Department of Defense, has placed in this Guantanamo Bay off-site non-domestic facility. It is not a part of the Department of Corrections. It is a naval base. Placed many, many prisoners at that Guantanamo Bay detention facility who the Pentagon, the Defense Department, has identified as terrorists, people who are threatening the safety and security of our nation and of other nations. And the challenge that these folks pose is just this, that the information that provides the basis for the Pentagon to incarcerate, to detain these people at Guantanamo Bay is most often acquired, is secured by virtue of intelligence, by secure intelligence that cannot be disclosed into the public domain. And for that reason, these individuals, based upon the assessment of the Pentagon, are so sufficiently dangerous that they cannot be released into the public, whether it's here in the United States or in another place, but nor can they be tried in a federal district court in mainland America based upon their terrorist activities. And we have seen, as you know well, we have seen domestic prosecutions of individuals for terrorism. In these instances, these more than handfuls of people, large numbers in the past of people, again, threats to our national security, our international security, but cannot, by virtue of the mechanisms by which that information has been acquired, can't produce that in a federal district court such that we can go ahead and prosecute them in that public domain. So the question is, what does one do then? What does a civilized nation do with these people? Well, many of them have been relocated over time. And that is the story of one of these individuals who came into the news just this past week. As late as this past week, about 34 prisoners still fall into that category. They're still at Guantanamo Bay, and they are once again in this category of people, cannot be brought into federal district court, charged with federal crimes for their terrorist activities because of the nature of the intelligence that identified them in the first place. Of those 34, 11 of them have been charged in military commissions. And again, an awful lot of controversy about that in the public domain, including six of those who are awaiting capital trials, okay? So that is among the 34 of those detainees right now at Guantanamo Bay. Three others, all former CIA prisoners, are being held as indefinite detainees in what is called our continuing war on terrorism. Again, underscoring this great difficulty of what one does with someone who falls into this category. They're not accused of any crimes in our federal district courts, but they're considered simply too dangerous to release. The other 20 men or so, half of them from the nation of Yemen, have been approved for transfer to some other countries. In other words, we have now determined that they are no longer the threats that they otherwise were, with security agreements that satisfy the Secretary of Defense, the Pentagon, and arrangements that have been made that require some very complex diplomatic situations. And that leads us to the news that was in the news just this past week. We know, again, that an individual named Majid Sukhat Khan, K-H-A-M, he's 42 years old, will now be released from Guantanamo Bay among those 34 detainees held there for a long period of time, released to the authority of custodies in the nation of Belize. You may recall, you may know that Belize is this country in Central America, known perhaps for its barrier reef, beautiful nation, its ecotourism, that sort of thing. And the country of Belize has agreed to take Mr. Khan upon his release from Guantanamo Bay. This small Central American nation moving now to accept Mr. Khan post his incarceration at Guantanamo Bay. Many other prisoners, again, released in the recent years have been repatriated. Mr. Khan, who actually completed his prison sentence nearly a year ago, quite literally had nowhere to go. And upon the news this past week that he will be moved to Belize, the nation taking him out of this Guantanamo Bay detention, he said this. He said, "I've been given a second chance in life, and I intend to make the most of it and to become a productive, law-abiding member of society." He said, "I continue to ask for forgiveness from God and those I have hurt." And that underscores, that statement underscores both the difficulty of the Guantanamo Bay detainees and the situation there, but also the difficulty in figuring out what one does as a just and fair nation, the United States of America, what you do in these circumstances. Mr. Khan was perhaps among the better known of these detainees at Guantanamo Bay, among other things. He went to high school in Maryland, left his immigrant family for his native Pakistan, and then that's when he got into trouble. He joined al-Qaeda after the attacks of September 11th of 2001. From about 2006 to 2003 to 2006, he was in some secret CIA prisons overseas and kept in some dungeon-like conditions. And this is the part of the story that also is very troubling, not only for our nation's present review of these detainees, but its recent history as well. Mr. Khan, during the course of his detention by the CIA, was beaten. He was brutally forced some feedings, waterboarded, other physical and forms of even sexual abuse. Eventually, he agreed to testify against other prisoners. He agreed. He did, in fact, agree to plead guilty to plotting a never-realized suicide bombing years earlier involving Pakistan's president. And so he agreed to this particular crime. And he also delivered $50,000 that we used to finance a deadly attack in Indonesia. And so we have this person, Mr. Khan, who is both engaged in plainly terrorist activity, probably involved in other activities, but also subject inappropriately to treatment by our own forces in that location. Well, Mr. Khan now being released, the government of Belize, the ministry there saying, although Mr. Khan has contributed to many acts of terrorism, he was also brutally abused and tortured, has repudiated radicalism, cooperated with U.S. authorities in the fight against terrorism, and has served his time. So in overall, this balancing resulting this past week in Mr. Khan being moved to Belize, one among the 34 still in Guantanamo. A continuing story this morning and in the future. Join us, continue to stay with us right after this break as we talk about more stories in the rule of law in the United States of America.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
The Devil's Advocates.
But do you think the Biden administration's calling up Laura Ingraham and making the announcement to the world that we're invading Russia with amphibious troops? Come on, Trump. I mean, and I want to hear fine Trumpsters that want to defend that crap. You know, he's a little late for the early bird buffet. Maybe you people were just naive marks who believed he was a super genius.
Then I got some land I'd like to sell you outside of Fukushima.
Check out the entire podcast library at darnwi.com.
It's Friday.
Oh, it is Friday.
It was a short week, and it still feels like it was a long week. And we did it!
We did. Well, we're almost
done. We almost did it. We're still going to get through today. But we did it. We live to tell about it. We're having fun.
Yeah. All kinds of fun things planned for today.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Always on the Civic Media app. You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Here's your updated forecast. A blend of clouds and sun this afternoon with daytime highs approaching 32. Winds out of the southwest, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows level off around 25 tonight. Cloudy skies expected. Cloudy skies expected again tomorrow. Highs level off around 32. Dry and turning warmer Monday and Tuesday with highs in the upper 30s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on 98.3 FM and 1100 AM WISS. Right now, 16.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
We are back, continuing on this great Saturday morning to discuss a number of different items in the news that underscore important lessons, important instruction about the rule of law in America, the way in which we live, the way in which we understand our system of justice, the things that we should expect from our courts, our police, our law enforcement authorities, all representatives of government, and the lawyers who are also in court on a regular basis. And that takes us to our next story this morning. It involves Kyle Rittenhouse. Kyle Rittenhouse, many of you know well. He is this Chicago-based, Illinois-based young man who was accused back in August of 2020 with shooting three men, two of them fatally, during the horrific civil unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. At his trial in November of 2021 in the state court in Kenosha, you know as well that a jury found Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty of murder and of all other charges after he testified in his own defense. And again, since that time, has become something of a cause célèbre in right-wing organizations who have touted him not only as a Second Amendment advocate, if you will, with respect to firearms, but also someone generally in the public eye regarding civil unrest and the social conditions of America in 2020, 2021, 2022, and certainly to this day. Well, Kyle Rittenhouse back in the news again this past week, this time in federal court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. In a case that's pending before Judge Lynn Edelman. Judge Lynn Edelman is a United States District Court judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And Judge Edelman has before him a lawsuit. It's a civil lawsuit, not a criminal case. Kyle Rittenhouse cannot be retried for that offense conduct. But what has happened is that in the wake of all of those activities, including his acquittal for those murders, those offenses in Kenosha County, a lawsuit is filed by John Huber. John Huber is the father of one of the two victims of Kyle Rittenhouse, and the lawsuit also identifies some city officials, some police officers, as people who are responsible for the wrongful death of Mr. Huber's son. And so in the course of reviewing this litigation brought to allege a wrongful death, again, a civil lawsuit, the allegation is that Rittenhouse conspired with police officers to intentionally cause harm to the protesters who were marching in reaction, as you may recall, to the shooting of Jacob Blake that happened not long before those protests in that city. And during the course of this lawsuit, the allegation is that by virtue of this so-called wrongful death, that Mr. Huber and presumably other members of his family civilly damaged by virtue of what Kyle Rittenhouse did. Rittenhouse, as I indicated, an Illinois resident, had driven to Wisconsin and was a minor, age 17 at the time, now plainly an adult. So what happens is, in this particular case, that the defendants, including Rittenhouse and the other city officials and police officers, file a motion to dismiss. And so there's no cause of action here. Nothing to see here, Judge. Dismiss this case. Dismiss the wrongful death action that has been brought by Mr. Huber on behalf of his fallen son. And the judge says no. Judge says no. Under the federal civil rights laws, he permits this lawsuit to go ahead. In the ruling specifically, Judge Adelman said that Huber's death could plausibly be regarded as having been proximately caused by the actions of the government defendants. Goes on to say Huber was killed after Rittenhouse was running after he shot and killed his first victim in the parking lot of a car dealership, and Huber hit Rittenhouse with a skateboard to disarm him. All of those facts that, of course, recalled very well by all of us who were following these events in that area at the time. After falling to the ground, again, Adelman not only recounts these stories, but also pulls them from the news accounts of the time, Rittenhouse fatally shot Huber and wounded another protester. His name is Gage Grosskreutz, who had also filed a civil lawsuit against Rittenhouse. Interestingly, Huber's lawyers, again, the ones who were advocating for this wrongful death action, encountered some very significant problems in serving, locating Rittenhouse more recently to serve him with this civil lawsuit paperwork. They eventually served him at the sister's house. Rittenhouse's lawyers in this civil wrongful death action had claimed that the case should be dismissed in addition to being on the merits, but also because he was not properly served. And the judge also dismissed that claim as well. So significant that a federal district court judge in Milwaukee, in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, is now permitting this lawsuit, this civil rights lawsuit, to go ahead against Kyle Rittenhouse and others among the defendant group for the wrongful death of one of the individuals who was killed as a result of that social unrest, and in particular, Kyle Rittenhouse's murder and his shooting of those victims at that time. We'll continue to monitor that as well as the civil lawsuit goes ahead. Plainly, next steps in that case, as in many others, involving discovery, the taking of depositions, which means that Kyle Rittenhouse and city officials, the police officers, others involved who may have relevant information about what happened that night, all of them can be deposed. Again, not in a criminal proceeding. This is not a grand jury. This is not a criminal trial. But during the course of discovery, in anticipation of a civil trial, that will proceed in the months, perhaps even years ahead. And at some point down the road, Judge Adelman perhaps will schedule a trial in his own court there in the federal district court. And that could proceed at some point down the road on the merits of this case, could also be the subject of settlement. And so we'll continue to watch that case as it goes forward, again, seeking wrongful death judgment, all of that related to judgments in the form of money. Money that could, in fact, be granted to Mr. Huber and others for the violence with respect to his son. When we come back, more stories about the rule of law in America. Stay with us for that discussion. When you see the man do his stuff, done seen enough. Oh, moving the shoulder. Gotta get it moving side to side.
You're listening to a Civic Media radio station. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Chinese spy balloon is now heading toward the East Coast. The Pentagon now talking about possibly shooting it down. ABC News contributor Colonel Steve Ganyard, a former defense and State Department official, says
That would have been easier when the balloon was first spotted.
The Pentagon said that they detected it out over the Aleutians, way, way wet, to the west. And it went up over Alaska. Those are not heavily populated areas. So days ago, it was a political decision not to shoot it down. Now it's a safety issue.
The idea not shooting it down when it crosses the East Coast over the Atlantic, but before it drifts into international waters. Much of the nation in the grips of a deep freeze, the Northeast feeling the extreme chill overnight. Wind chill approaching 60 degrees below zero in parts of New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and a blizzard morning. Whiteout conditions as well. Pope Francis starting his first full day on his visit to South Sudan, the world's newest country beset by conflict, poverty, and humanitarian crises, by encouraging priests and nuns to serve their flocks by joining in their tears. This is ABC News.
Join the conversation with your favorite hosts or shows anytime. Follow Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Share your thoughts on our social media channels wherever you are, whenever you want. The Civic Media Network of local radio stations here for you.
Warning, listening to the Devil's Advocates may expose you to opposing views.
It's scary. Maybe I am coming a little bit more over the left, but...
Well, it's not left, it's good governance, Steve.
It's good to be exposed to different ideas, and I do appreciate that you do put that out there on the airways, because a lot of times where you just get a little soundbite of this or a little bit of that, and that's the end of it. You're to be commended for that.
Dave, I'm glad you finally come around to commending the greatest radio show ever, man.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When we got back from the Working Class Heroes radio tour, one of the things that people asked is, what'd you learn? As you're going through rural America, what'd you find? Found angry people, and angry for cause. But the sad reality is they've been fed decades of outrage candy, and they're angry at the wrong people. They're angry at their neighbors. They're not angry at the very wealthy where they should be. Be sure to tune in live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network, and have your voice heard.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It is the Monday after the first Packers game, and I think everyone right now is licking their wounds.
But I do love that you're leading with The Bears Still Suck as the intro song. I mean, we're already on to week two.
Why are we not good at the season opener?
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Always on the Civic Media app.
Over the years, you've really kept up with the times. You're on social media.
Like, dislike, block.
Maintained your health.
10,000 steps. I'm a beast.
You even programmed your own smart home.
In 10 minutes, remind me that I'm a genius.
In 10 minutes, I'll remind you that you're a genius.
If you can do all that, you can definitely save for retirement. Just go to aceyourretirement.org, a free online tool sponsored by AARP that can help you get on track with your retirement savings no matter your age. At aceyourretirement.org, you'll meet Avo, the friendly digital retirement coach, and in just 3 minutes, get personalized recommendations to help boost your retirement savings. They're easy to understand and work with your lifestyle. It's quick, easy, and free. Plus, it's brought to you by AARP, so you know they got your back.
You are a genius.
Take charge of your retirement. Go to aceyourretirement.org now. That's aceyourretirement.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human...
And we are back for this final half hour. Always taking your phone calls here at Morning Cannolis. That is my wonderful producer and I at 844-967-2789. Join us for the discussion, offering your perspectives, your questions, your comments about these and other stories that may be in the news on your personal dockets. We're going to talk now about another civil case, this one also pending in a federal appeals court. We talked in the previous hour about this criminal case pending before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the South, finding the Section 922 of Title 18 is unconstitutional. A real blow to the safety and security of America when it comes to enforcing laws and prohibiting people who engage in domestic violence from possessing and using weapons. We'll see what happens with that one as it goes, presumably, to the United States Supreme Court. We've got another case on our docket this morning. This one comes out of the Third Circuit, basically eastern states, and in particular, New Jersey. New Jersey is the principal location, not the only one, but the principal location of Johnson & Johnson. You know them well for all of their medical products and other things that they produce, including a talc-based powder. I suspect that some, not all of you, have used in various iterations, various productions of that coming out of Johnson & Johnson and its products placed on the commercial tables and shelves for purchase. What happens here is that about 38,000 people come forward and they say that this particular product, among those powders that Johnson & Johnson produces, there's certain one of them that causes cancer. And J&J has repeatedly denied that allegation. So they've said it's not true. And so some of those lawsuits have proceeded around the country. J&J has recently done something that was the subject of this Court of Appeals decision by the Third Circuit. Again, a three-judge panel coming out of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And in particular, reviewing what happened in the bankruptcy court in one of the district courts there in New Jersey. What happens is this. We know that J&J places about $2 billion through a trust to pay some of these claims, an amount that many of the victims say is going to be insufficient. We also know along the way that J&J has an equity value about $400 billion with a B, a AAA credit rating, and about a $31 billion in cash and marketable securities. So a company that is wealthy and has some substantial financial holdings. What the J&J authorities and leadership does is this. They create something called the LTL Management Group, LTL Management. And they place all of these legal liabilities presented by these 38,000 lawsuits, by these claimants of injury under this talc powder administration, this talc powder use. They place all of the liabilities in LTL Management, and then they file in the United States Bankruptcy Court in New Jersey for Chapter 11, which basically means for reviewing the debts that this particular LTL Management may now have to all of these claimants. And again, for a company to do this, this is the focus of the Third Circuit Appeals Group. And they take a look at this and they basically say, no, you can't do this. The court says because LTL was not in financial distress, it was simply the holder of all of these potential liabilities. It cannot show, the court said, that its bankruptcy petition served a valid procedural purpose and that was filed in good faith. And as a result of this, sending a very strong message that J&J has done, Johnson & Johnson has done, in terms of trying to evade responsibility by dumping all of its potential liability into this shell company, if you will, and then seeking to reorganize under Chapter 11, that is not legal. And the Court of Appeals basically says, we know that what you're doing is simply an attempt to try to limit your exposure. We know well that under the bankruptcy courts, and an organization files for bankruptcy, in this case, J&J, through its subsidiary, this LTL Management, creditors typically have to negotiate collectively with the debtor in pursuit of a settlement, often for pennies sometimes, and the dollar in the case of litigation. So this is an attempt by J&J to try to evade the responsibility that would otherwise have to these talc powder victims, these 38,000 victims who maintain that they were affected by and affected dramatically by their own cancers as a result of their use of this talc powder. The Third Circuit once again saying you can't do this. And why is it significant? Why is it significant that J&J told, no, the bankruptcy itself will be dismissed. You, Johnson & Johnson, have this huge amount of money from which you can, in fact, pay if indeed there are findings in other courts that you're responsible for this. Why is this significant? Well, again, it shows the ways in which the courts are properly and then improperly used by some parties. This is a real slap on the wrist, not only for J&J, and it's more than a slap on the wrist procedurally because it sends them the news that they cannot use the bankruptcy court for this illegitimate purpose of trying to evade the financial judgments that would come to them by virtue of the prosecutions, the civil prosecutions against them. We have seen this kind of thing in at least two other areas. In 2021, you may recall that a judge dismissed the National Rifle Association's Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the same kind of thing, because the NRA, by its own admission, by its own pleadings in matters before that court, wasn't facing any financial troubles. It may, in fact, be in that situation now, but at that time, a couple of years ago, there was not evidence in the record to show that that was the case. The NRA has sought the protection of the bankruptcy court, again, in an attempt to delay a lawsuit by the New York State Attorney General. You know her name, and she is Letitia James, that was seeking to disband the organization. And the judge at that time, invoking the same rules, the same fundamental rule of law principles that the Third Circuit has now applied as to Johnson & Johnson, said you can't run into bankruptcy court as a way of getting rid of your liabilities, especially when you have enough money to pay. Bankruptcy court is not a safe haven, if you will, for doing that. That's what the court said in National Rifle Association. That's what the court said to Johnson & Johnson just this past week as well. There's another situation similar to this. Again, underscores the nature of the challenge of using the courts properly in the United States of America. 3M, you know them well, the conglomerate, had placed something called Aero Technologies, a subsidiary of it, once again, into bankruptcy. And it was hoping at that time to process, through this bankruptcy process, to speed a settlement of more than 230,000 lawsuits from military service members who had accused Aero earplugs of causing hearing loss. And once again, the court said he can't do that. The bankruptcy court is a way of reorganizing debts. It's a place where you can, in fact, discharge debts if indeed you are in real financial problem. 3M, at that time, once again, not the case. And so there again, the case was dismissed, thrown out of bankruptcy court, and the judge saying, cannot use the court for this illegitimate, inappropriate purpose. The case involving Johnson & Johnson, of course, first and foremost, hugely important, hugely significant for the plaintiffs. Those 38,000 people who claim that by using the Johnson & Johnson product, this talc powder, that they have gotten cancer. And those claims can now be pursued in the trial courts, the claims made without the protection, if you will, that Johnson & Johnson sought of the United States Bankruptcy Court. We know as well that others, not only the NRA, not only Aero Technologies and 3M, we've also seen people like Alex Jones threaten to go into bankruptcy as a way of evading the billions of judgments also against him. Likely the courts to follow this continuing precedent set by the Johnson & Johnson case, other cases saying that you cannot run into bankruptcy court as a way of evading your otherwise important responsibilities out there. That, again, coming from the Third Circuit, an appropriate decision by the Third Circuit, ensuring that corporate America is held responsible not only for its conduct, if it is proven to be so in a trial on the merits of these claims, but also doesn't run into court to try to evade the responsibility when it has sufficient monies to satisfy those judgments if indeed they are ultimately entered. And so another important case coming out in appeals court. And now as a part of our continuing review to this day of some significant events, another significant prosecution, this one in New York City. This is also in federal court, in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York. This case coming out once again in the wake of a significant investigation conducted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation against an individual named Charles McGonigal. McGonigal is his last name. He was a former chief of counterintelligence for the FBI, and the allegations against him now by prosecutors in the United States District Court in the Southern District of New York are that he was working secretly for a fellow named Oleg Deripaska, and he was investigating this Russian entity, this Russian person, at the same time that he was also getting benefits from him, getting paid by him. So what we have here is a case of an internal employee of the FBI now charged with aiding this very significant oligarch. Oleg Deripaska, many of you recall, was also the subject of a lot of inquiry. He was the subject of an indictment under the so-called Mueller investigation, remains under that indictment. And during the course of that Mueller investigation and other proceedings by the FBI, identified as one of the people who should, in fact, be charged federally. So what we have here, again, is this former FBI official in New York overseeing some of the agency's most secret and sensitive counterintelligence accusations, being accused of taking money from the very person that he is supposedly investigating. Very significant prosecution charges against him. Federal prosecutors said that McGonigal, who is 54 years old, specifically broke federal law by agreeing to help Deripaska, who was indicted himself, as I said, on sanctions charges, investigating a rival oligarch and trying to get off that sanctions list. The charges, once again, are hugely serious. It's a rare accusation against a senior FBI official, and they demonstrate again, as we saw in the time of the Mueller report, that the reach of Russia's oligarchs can extend perhaps even into the heart of American law enforcement. The indictment, which was unsealed the week before last, again, returned by a federal grand jury, reviewing all this information and determining in the end that there is probable cause to believe that these offense conduct, this set of offense conduct, did in fact take place, that he took about $225,000 in secret cash payments from this Deripaska fellow who had served with Albania intelligence previous to that. And McGonigal, of course, again, while he's doing this, concealed that relationship, concealed the fact that he was on the payroll of the very person that he was supervising, investigating as a part of his investigative work. In an email to the FBI employees, Christopher Wray, who we know is the present director of the FBI, identified once again the great challenge that this prosecution presents to the FBI, finding again internal to its own people that this has happened, but also noting that the great majority of FBI officers and special agents and staff do not engage in this sort of behavior, which really is traitorous in many ways. It is contrary to the very mission and purpose of the FBI, contrary certainly to the best interests of the United States of America. In an email to all of the employees of the FBI, when this indictment was unsealed and presented into the public domain, Christopher Wray called the conduct of the defendant here, Charles McGonigal, entirely inconsistent, he said, with what I see from the men and women of the FBI who demonstrate every day through their actions that they're worthy of the public's trust. Again, those are the words of the FBI director. Again, charges like this are very rare. In 2018, Andrew McCabe, the former acting and deputy director, was referred for prosecution after the Justice Department Inspector General accused him of misleading investigators, but that case was eventually dropped. In 1996, a senior official also charged him in connection with a deadly 92 standoff, and that case likewise pursued in the courts. When we come back, we'll talk more about the importance of this case and other matters within the rule of law ambit of our nation in 2023. Stay with us.
Did you know your favorite shows and hosts are active on social media too? Find Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and be part of the conversation happening there. And go to our website, civicmedia.us, to learn more about the Civic Media Network.
The Devil's Advocates.
Jake from Milwaukee, you get the last word this hour.
Okay, well, Trump is totally innocent. It's obvious that George Soros, Nancy Pelosi, BLM, with Antifa, and then Hillary's emails, what, Hunter Biden's laptop, gas, high, Afghanistan, cut and run. I rest my case, Truth.
What about Benghazi, Jake? You forgot Benghazi.
I'm sorry. And Benghazi, I rest my case.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Women get a lot of advice about self-care these days, but one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast. Partly cloudy this afternoon with a high of 32. Winds out of the southwest, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 25. Tonight, cloudy skies expected. Cloudy tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 32. Dry and turning warmer Monday and Tuesday with highs in the upper 30s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on 98.3 FM and 1100 AM WISS. Right now, 16.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
Not only the trust placed in him, but also some very specific federal laws prohibiting, obviously, this kind of conduct. Significant as well that a second man named Sergei Shestakov, 69 years old, he was a former Soviet and Russian diplomat who became a U.S. citizen, charged along with McGonigal. Shestakov worked as an interpreter in the federal courts and the U.S. Attorney's offices for the Southern and Eastern districts of New York. Again, charged along with McGonigal for this kind of conduct. I mentioned right before the break that it is rare, but it does in fact happen from time to time that we have individuals inside the FBI. We've seen some CIA prosecutions as well for people who violate the trust, the oath of office placed in them. And I mentioned that there was a case. It was pursued in the federal courts. 1996, a senior official was charged with obstruction in connection with the deadly standoff at Ruby Ridge, which you may recall was this 1992 standoff, remote section of Idaho. About two decades before that, an acting FBI director and a deputy, along with another official, was charged with conspiracy for some break-ins at the homes of political dissidents without warrants. And again, all of those kinds of things underscore the violations of basic trust that unfortunately can happen. At the other extreme, there is the statement made again by the director of the FBI, directors of FBI, whenever these kinds of charges come forward, that confirm for America that the great majority of FBI special agents and staff and officers are good people who understand their oath of office. And indeed, the last part of this report on McGonigal was the amount of shock that this was seen among former colleagues when they found out that McGonigal had done all of this. Many of them said he primarily investigated Russian counterintelligence and espionage. Shocking, they said, to see that the very thing that he was investigating was the very thing that he was also engaged in, again, getting money from Deripaska for his relationship of a highly inappropriate nature. McGonigal now facing some very serious charges and also facing some very serious prison time if indeed he is convicted of those charges in the Federal District Court in the Southern District of New York. And that brings us to our final story of the morning, and that is in the Manhattan, in New York, but in a state court, and not a federal court, a state court there. We know just from this past week, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office once again pursuing a Donald Trump. Information released that the district attorney there in Manhattan, his name is Alvin Bragg, is apparently nearing a decision about whether to charge the former president, Donald Trump, with his role in paying some hush money to a porn star during the 2016 presidential campaign. And we know this because, in part, he is presenting evidence of this to a state grand jury. Again, not a federal grand jury, but a state grand jury that has been convened to review all of this. And this is a story that we have spoken about on this broadcast and in others of civic media way back in 2016 when payments were made through Michael Cohen, who was the former president's principal handler, his fixer, his lawyer, to provide information, provide payments to at least one, if not two people, who purportedly had a sexual relationship, an affair with then-candidate Trump during the course of the election. And we know as well, in the wake of those allegations, we know that Michael Cohen actually went to prison, went to federal prison for his involvement in those payments to those people, that being a federal violation, a violation of the federal election laws. But we know also that in the wake of the Michael Cohen prosecution, nothing more happened in the federal venue. An awful lot of people scratching their head, wondering about what happened, and an awful lot of information out there now suggesting that Maine Justice stopped the further investigation of that matter federally. And now, in the wake of this recent news coming out of Manhattan, being picked up by the state prosecutor, the Manhattan DA, if you will, who is now looking at it again to see if there are violations, not of federal law under the federal elections law, but whether or not there are state violations having to do with finances and accounting and reporting on those monies. Significant, of course, that this investigation, initiated again by Bragg, apparently nearing some decision about whether or not this event could support charges against the former president, being pursued again in front of a state grand jury there in Manhattan. We know as well that Bragg was responsible through his prosecutors for the recent criminal conviction of the Trump Corporation. Again, same court, same kind of thing, that for basically tax fraud under the state, New York State tax code. And we know as well that Bragg was responsible for the prosecution of the chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg. All of that coming out of this same prosecution office recently in the Manhattan court. This one, obviously, following up on that, much related to it because of its focus on finances and on the possibility that monies that were paid by the former president, perhaps by members of his family, his son as well, funneled through Michael Cohen to a fellow named David Pecker, who is a former publisher of the National Enquirer, basically to stop this story from being published about the then-president Trump's, as he was a candidate, his candidacy being marred, perhaps, by reporting of his affairs with these women. And so, again, significant because the state now picking up on a situation where the federal government did not pursue similar charges. Certainly looking forward to what the state grand jury there may do down the road when it comes to further prosecutions in this area generally. The Trump Corporation, of course, we know, as we always state, that all individuals are presumed innocent until proven guilty, but an awful lot of things there in Manhattan percolating up. We know as well that the state attorney general as well, we mentioned Letitia James as well, likewise looking at a civil case against the Trump Corporation and Trump companies, including the family, seeking about $250 million for their involvement in some valuations matters as well. And finally, as we go into our last minute or so here on Morning Cannolis, reminder of important Supreme Court cases coming up. February 21 and February 22, this month, 2023, the United States Supreme Court taking a look at this case that I mentioned before about the liability of website providers, online platform providers, when it comes to postings of its users. We'll talk about those and other cases, future broadcasts right here in Morning Cannolis. For now, we encourage you to hear in our future broadcasts more about all of these stories and more. Stay with us every Friday morning, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 right here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thanks for joining me this morning and every morning. The future of America, the future of the state of Wisconsin. Be well.
Miss our conversations on air? Join the discussion on our social media channels. Find Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find social media for specific shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When we got back from the Working Class Heroes radio tour, one of the things that people asked is, what'd you learn? As you're going through rural America, what'd you find? Found angry people, and angry for cause. But the sad reality is they've been fed decades of outrage candy, and they're angry at the wrong people. They're angry at their neighbors. They're not angry at the very wealthy where they should be. Be sure to tune in live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network, and have your voice heard.
You're listening to WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay.